on RN or online at abc.net.au. Hello, Paul Barclay with you for Big Ideas. Are we living in the shadow of the next great extinction? Is there a silent extermination happening around us? Some estimates are that half of all plant, animal and bird species could be gone by the end of the century. It's a sobering thought, and so tonight, RN's Greg Borschmann leads a panel of eminent Australian biologists to discuss how a massive loss of biodiversity might be averted. Contributing to this discussion, we're joined by Leslie Hughes, Distinguished Professor who heads the Climate Change Ecology Group at Macquarie University. Hugh Possingham, Professor of Mathematics and Ecology at the University of Queensland. Scott Gorringe, Director and Founder of Murray Matters Consulting, a Mythica man from Queensland's Channel Country. And Professor Richard Kingsford, Director of the Centre for Ecosystem Science at the University of New South Wales. Let's now head off to the Taronga Zoo in Sydney. Here's our moderator, Greg Borschmann.
So, the extinction crisis. Richard Kingsford, an estimated 1,000 species have disappeared in the past 200,000 years. That doesn't sound like an extinction crisis.
Well, I mean, I think we tend to think extinction, and that's a natural process. You know, there's a whole range in humans evolving. There are a whole lot of species that have become extinct to where we are today. But we forget that it's not necessarily just the extinction, it's the rate of extinction. So the background rate, we're going about 1,000 times and maybe a lot more times the background rate of extinction. So that means that we're losing, you know, 1,000 times more species than would be naturally lost through natural processes. And that's frightening because a lot of the time those are species we know about. Most of biodiversity are from the insect world, the bacteria world, the virus world. We don't know hardly anything about that. We're just talking about the sort of charismatic megafauna and the loss of those, and they should be a very strong signal about what's actually going on.
Hugh Possingham, has science signed off on the sixth great extinction, or is there argument? Is this contested ground? Do we have mass extinction skeptics?
No, I think Bjorn Lomborg was a sceptic. He was a sceptic about everything in his book, but in the end he also signed off on the mass extinction we're in the middle of. So, and in fact, it's interesting we can record this 1,000 times rate we're sitting in now. We're in it, in the middle of it. And in the end, it's not a meteorite hitting the planet. It may play out over 200 or 300 years, as you say. But we should not also forget that when Homo sapiens swept through the Pacific, the estimate is that 400 to 1,000 species of bird went extinct on islands colonised by Polynesians and Melanesians. So there has been, we're part of a process of the human colonisation of the planet and the intensification and the growth to 7 billion people, and that whole process is catastrophic. That Polynesian expansion accounts for probably 5% of the world's bird species disappearing in one period of maybe only 1,000 years. So yes, the nobody disputes the mass extinction. The question is, can we stop it?
Mm. Scott Gorringe, 5 million hectares of Queensland's Channel Country is your home country. Do you see an extinction crisis in the Channel Country?
Well, you mentioned there earlier, I'm a Mythica man, and the people that I belong to is Black Hawks. At our way, we used to have, we got budgerigar people, you know, that's their totem. We got galahs. We also got the kangaroos and the emus that, you know, people belong to. We used to have possums. There's no more possums out there. I've never seen a possum in my lifetime, and I never heard, you know, some of them old people talk about them much either. So there's definitely extinctions happening out that way. The cattle industry has been operating out in Channel Country for many, many years, and the damage that they're doing to waterways as well as the natural vegetation for species to live in is pretty massive. And now we've got the potential of large mining operations going on out there. So I think we're in danger of losing a lot more, not only animals but our fish and our birds, in real danger, I think.
Leslie Hughes, before we start talking about climate change, which we will, can we talk about wars, pollution, hunting, fishing, farming, habitat loss? Because that's what's driving this sixth great extinction, isn't it? Human fingerprints are all over this one, aren't they?
Yes, they certainly are. You know, even without climate change, we'd be in trouble. So, you know, humans are clearing about 1 million square kilometres of vegetation on Earth every year. Just that. We take about 25% of all primary productivity from continental shelves in our fisheries. For example, we use somewhere between 30 and 50% of the planet's surface are exploited by people. So we have, as a species, just an enormous impact, even without what's coming to hit us in the future.
Okay, so let's go to climate change. Mass extinction, it has all happened before. Why are you so convinced that this one is different? And I think we need to reference the paper that you co-authored 11 years ago, back in 2004. You co-authored a paper in the journal Nature, which made some pretty alarming predictions about biodiversity loss and climate change. What were they? Because they were certainly hot at the time. It was a very contested paper.
It was a very controversial paper. A lot of people, including a lot of scientists, really hated it. It made the claim that, based on some modelling, somewhere between 38 and 50% of all species on the planet would be at higher risk of extinction than they are now. The words were committed to extinction by 2050 because of climate change. It was a very bold paper. Since then, there's a lot of new calculations and better methods, and they've come up with more or less the same numbers. But the really important thing about that paper is that I think it got the phrases climate change and species extinction together in the public consciousness as they hadn't been perhaps so tightly linked before. And I think getting those messages into the public consciousness is a really important part of the conservation message.
So how much time do we have? Because this has all happened rather quickly. No one was talking about the extinction crisis or climate change in the 1970s. You've famously tried to capture these collapsing timelines in a slide now known as Leslie's climate change slide. What is it?
It's actually called Leslie's grandkids slide, and I should hasten to add I don't have any grandchildren yet. But I often show a slide at presentations, and I'm sure there's some people in the audience that have seen it, where I put the climate projections for the next century on the slide, showing under a business-as-usual scenario we could get about 7 degrees of warming compared to pre-industrial times by the end of the century, which is a pretty horrifying prospect. But on that, and a lot of people in the public look at, I know, you can see their eyes glaze over as soon as you put up any form of a graph. So to try and make it sort of a bit more personal and a bit more meaningful, a couple of years ago when I was on the Climate Commission, I put my own lifespan on that graph at the average temperature that I will experience over my lifespan. I have two teenage kids that were born in the mid-90s. I put their lifespan on. And then assuming that my kids have kids when they're about 30, I put my hypothetical grandchildren on there as well. And what it shows is that my grandkids will live into the next century and could experience mean annual temperatures of 5 or 7 or even greater amounts of warming above pre-industrial times.
Under business as usual.
Under business as usual. Yeah. And just to put that in perspective, we've had about a degree of warming so far. If we get to 1.5 degrees, that's the warmest planet than at any time since humans have evolved.
Mm. Hugh Possingham, you're more of an optimist. You're not so worried about climate change. Is this because you figure that the Chinese will just geoengineer a solution before the crunch comes?
Yes, basically, because people don't want to suffer. They don't want to have a 5 degree C hotter world. And the crops we've organised to grow in certain places are very sensitive to climate. And nature is sensitive, but I'm not sure it's as sensitive as the system we've created. I mean, how many people, what's the statistics on how many people live within 5 metres of the sea level? I mean, the current high tides. So I just think people don't like suffering, they don't want pain, they don't want high temperatures, and they'll sort of sort it out. So I tend to also work on the things I can stop, which is things like land clearing, water extraction, fire regimes, stopping stupid organisms coming to Australia. They're the things I can do something about. I can't probably stop climate change, and I'm hoping that the 7 billion people on the planet just don't want to fry, and they'll do it for their own sake.
Let's look at some of the threats. We've talked about climate change. Richard Kingsford, your assessment is that we're failing to protect species, failing to protect habitat, but also what you call the big processes across the landscape. What do you mean?
Well, I think fundamentally we're talking about big ecosystems that demand processes that are very important. You can think of, as we talked to Scott, the Lake Eyre Basin rivers. They depend, the heart of Australia, sixth of the continent, depends on the boom and bust and the uninterrupted flow that comes down that system. The Great Barrier Reef depends on a whole range of really big processes. And I think, you know, we're not in the Anthropocene, what we're calling the Anthropocene, by mistake. We are the species that is able to change everything in this world, including the geology. And our ability to interfere with those big processes, I think, worries me, because I don't think we have the conservation mechanisms to adequately protect ecosystems. I think our national parks are very important, protected areas, but until we stop the way our species is interfering with the life-sustaining biological and non-biological processes, we're not really dealing with the big problem, and that's a real challenge.
Small saves, big losses, that's what you're saying.
That's right.
Mm. Okay, look, Hugh Possingham, I'd like to come back to you, because Australia already has 500 national parks. Almost 10% of the continent is protected in national park or conservation reserve, state forest, or even private conservation lease. But you say we need to protect more and people actually want more. Where's the evidence?
Yeah, so the Zoological Society of London did a massive global survey. They interviewed hundreds and hundreds of people in about 20 countries, and they asked the people of the world, how much should of your country be in national parks? And the average was 50%. It was remarkable, 50%. So it doesn't matter whether you're living in Burkina Faso or whether you're living in the United States, people want 50% for nature. So we were expecting 30% or 20%, and we were just trying to move it above the CBD targets of 17% so we could get a bigger number, but they said 50%. So people want a lot more conservation. I think the trick in Australia is we have a park system that's sort of somewhere between about 13 to 15%, depending how you count parks. There's two issues there. One is it's not a representative system. There's whole ecosystem types that are completely absent from the park system. The second thing is we just don't spend enough money managing it. Much of it is unmanaged. It is very difficult. The park services, particularly outside the well-populated rich states, the states like South Australia and Queensland, they are struggling to look after the small parks, the park system they have. So we need a much bigger investment in the park system.
We'll come back to the money. I'd like to go to you, Scott Gorridge, because you've gone to the United Nations, the special rapporteur on the rights of Indigenous people, with your concerns over oil and coal seam gas development, fracking, exploration leases cover a third of the Channel Country. That's over 1.7 million hectares. What's your concern? Because clearly you are concerned.
Yeah, we have huge concerns, and it's not only traditional owners out in the Channel Country. I'm one of about, I think, six traditional owners groups that sit on the Cooper and the Diamantina and the Georgina, and they're the three big rivers that fill Lake Eyre. If you're wondering where the country that I come from is, think about Lake Eyre. It's probably the most iconic piece of water in Australia. And there's three big rivers that fill it. I belong to two of them, the Cooper and the Diamantina. And the concerns that we have, the reason why we've gone to the UN is the Queensland government, I don't know if they're in power now or if they're, I don't know who's in power up there, but the LNP, through their political powers, ignored what the people were asking for out there. And now that country has opened up to coal seam gas, shale gas operations and irrigation. So the concern that we have is those waterways will be damaged because of the uncertainty of those kind of extraction methods and the danger of sucking water out of rivers that don't flow regular. And we see what's going on in the Murray. We've had to deal with that in the last 10 or 15 years. So we don't want those sort of things to happen out our way. So I went to the UN with the backing of the traditional owner groups out our way to see if we can get the Queensland government to listen. Not only listen, but to sit down and at least have a conversation with us. We've been totally ignored through this process. So that's why we've gone to the UN, so we can protect our waterways and our land.
Leslie Hughes, look, I'd like to get very specific here because we constantly wrestle with the conflict between conservation and development. Very recently here in New South Wales, we saw planning approval for three new or expanded coal mines that will produce an extra 400 million tonnes of coal every year. Rio Tinto's Bengala mine extension in the Hunter Valley alone will deliver an estimated $1.3 billion in federal and state royalties and protect 900 jobs. And apart from those royalties and jobs, relatively few of the, quote, residual impacts were assessed by the State Planning and Assessment Commission as being of major concern. I think I'm safe to say that you disagree. Why?
Well, let me quote another Nature paper that just came out in January this year, which has developed this concept that has been around for a while of unburnable carbon. And it calculated how much of the world's known fossil fuel reserves, that's oil, gas and coal, need to be left in the ground and unburned in order for the world to achieve no more than 2 degrees of warming above pre-industrial levels. And the figure that they put on it was 88% of all coal reserves need to be left in the ground. And in the case of Australia, 90% of our coal reserves need to be left in the ground and unburnt to have any chance of reaching that target, or at least not exceeding that target. So we can, you know, whether you talk about individual coal mines, whether they be in the Galilee Basin in Queensland or in the Hunter Valley in New South Wales, we actually cannot afford to dig that stuff up and burn it to have a safe and stable climate.
Richard Kingsford, you talk about the march of development and your concern for Central Australia and also Northern Australia. What, in terms of what we're talking about tonight, the extinction crisis, the biodiversity loss, what's your concern here?
Well, I think it's those big processes. And in particular, I mean, we're a very dry continent. We use water in a profligate way, particularly in agriculture. And we've had a sort of open slather when it comes to rivers. And my big concern is the cost of developing our water resources in Central Australia, and particularly with the push by both major parties into Northern Australia. Now, that means two things, essentially. It means establishing agriculture around developing water resources and clearing land for agriculture. Now, we have one of the world's great wilderness savanna areas in Northern Australia. We have one of the most biodiverse places on this planet, and we're about to make exactly the same mistakes that we made in the Murray-Darling. And it seems like we just don't learn. We've spent more than $12 billion trying to return flows to the Murray-Darling, and we have a patient, if you like, that's just out of the critical care unit. I mean, our Murray-Darling is still stumbling around, very much incapacitated. And we're about to jump into developing some of these wonderful natural systems where I think there are other options, there are more sustainable options, there are ways in which we can engage with the traditional owners about what sort of produce we can produce with lessening the footprint we have on these river systems. I was just talking about a week ago to Trevor Wright, who runs air charters out of Lake Eyre, and Lake Eyre is just filled from the local storms, and there's so many people want to get out there and appreciate our landscape. Now, we're in danger, well, particularly with some of these developments, in danger of threatening that long-term sustainability, both economically and also environmentally.
Let's talk about some of the potential solutions. Richard Kingsford, last year the New South Wales government announced a plan to reintroduce 8 extinct species in New South Wales, species that once occurred in New South Wales but are now no longer here, have been lost locally. I do understand you're involved in one of the groups pitching for this project, but what's the idea, and are we in danger of simply creating an expensive, unsustainable zoo?
Well, I mean, I think people are trying to be innovative, trying to think about how do we actually re-engineer, if you like, these ecosystems. And so I think the real challenge here is we've generally gone about this process by thinking there are a whole lot of sort of mid-sized herbivores, various wallabies and things like, and bandicoots that we just reintroduce, we throw them in there and we forget about them. I think our real challenge here is to try and reintroduce the whole of the ecosystem so that we have predators in there as well as herbivores, and we are thinking about these systems as self-maintaining in the sense that the vegetation isn't overgrazed and we have some natural regulatory systems in place. Now, obviously, the main threatening process we're trying to deal with here are feral predators. So we're talking about foxes and cats, and they're a real challenge. And in the first instance, there's not much more you can do than try and fence these things out to establish these populations of locally extinct native animals. And I think that's the first step. And then I think in the long term, once you have established that sort of ecosystem structure, then you have to be really quite innovative about how do you manage the boundaries. Because in a sense, we don't want to create a whole series of zoos. We want to try and have self-maintaining populations. We're beginning to understand much better the role of things like dingoes in maintaining and regulating populations of foxes and cats. And I think, you know, if you like, that's a part of some of the solutions. And I think it's potentially an exciting one.
Mm. That was one of the questions that we had tonight from the audience about the role that the Tassie devil, the Tasmanian devil, may play reintroduced into the mainland. Could I just do a quick whip around and just get a sense? And perhaps, Scott, when you give your answer, rather than the Tassie devil, you could talk about the dingo. Richard, you're clearly in favour of this idea?
Well, I think so. I think if you can protect these organisms from, you know, the big feral predators, they can potentially have a regulatory role. It's with Tassie devils, you're going to have to go very slowly, and obviously with all of these animals, think about what their historic range is. You don't want to introduce things that weren't really adapted to that landscape.
Mm. Scott Gorringe, we already have the dingo in Australia on the mainland. We're doing a very good job poisoning and trapping it at the moment. Is dingo friend or foe in your country?
It's a hard question. Some people, it's friend. For me, I've always been a little bit partial to the dingo. I don't like the wild dogs. I don't like the cats. I don't like the pigs. I don't like the
donkeys
cane toads,
and the camels.
The donkeys and the camels.
They're That's all a ones. Long list.
I'm more concerned with them than the poor old dingoes. I think dingoes are getting a bad rap, and I think, you know, we should be protecting those and bringing them back in into our lands out that way to balance it all up again.
Hugh Possingham, what we're talking about here is trying to bring things back as well as trying to save what we've got. We're in the territory of triage. You've used mathematics to help come up with a triage model, saving what we can afford. What is it?
Basically says, given the pitifully miserable spending we have on the environment, then we can probably save about 10 or 20% of what we should be saving. So it's useless. So if you can hardly do anything, then do what you possibly can.
But hang on a minute. You say it's actually not going to bust the bank, or at least Treasury. For $100 million, we can secure all species, and another $100 million to start making a positive difference.
Yeah, definitely.
Congratulations. You are now the Federal Minister for the Environment.
That's right. $100 million a year. It's hardly anything. I mean, defence spending is $26 billion a year. That means every 2 weeks we spend $1 billion defending a country that, as far as I last looked, nobody's attacking. I don't know. We actually seem to have a lot of people attacking somebody else. $26 billion, $1 billion, that's 2 weeks of defence funding. There's no doubt about it. That would basically secure Australia's biodiversity, which is securing our tourism industry, and would start to recover species, not just to exist, but to be functional, to be truly functional. And if it means bringing back Tasmanian devils, yeah, give it a try. Most of Australia is not functioning anything like what it should. So we need massive reform, and it is not a big expenditure. That tax bill that we all got back, where our money was spent on, you know, we were told where our money was spent with our taxes. I didn't see the environment bar. Did anybody see, where did they hide the environment bar? There was a whole heap on health and welfare and a whole various other things like defence. There was no environment bar at all. So, you know, I think the Australian people, given the Green vote sits around 10% in most states, I think they would like even just 1 or 2% of their money going on restoring habitat, recovering species, getting back ecosystem processes, water flows, fire regimes. Just 1 or 2% would do it. Why aren't we doing it? I have no idea.
A dedicated funding base for what Hugh Possingham is talking about here. We have a Medicare levy. Do we need a federal environment levy? 1%. Would that buy us time? Would that save the day? I don't know. Maybe we should do a straw poll tonight. I suspect few Australians would begrudge that sort of investment in our future.
Well, I mean, we've talked about the things that need to be done. I don't think there's any argument in the profession about what needs to be done. There's a lack of political will about it.
And a lack of money.
And lack of money. I think as well as being able to restore landscapes, I think the other thing that we have to invest in is being able to understand the trajectories of change. We have very few resources going into measuring things. So we're quite happy to measure a whole lot of economic indicators, and we're very poor at measuring environmental indicators. And so a lot of the time, we don't know how good our investments are. So it's a dual thing. We have to actually invest in those restoration measures, but we also have to be able to demonstrate how effective they are, and that requires resources.
You're with Big Ideas tonight. We're at the Taronga Zoo in Sydney for a discussion on the extinction crisis. Our expert panellists are Professor Richard Kingsford from the University of New South Wales, Professor Leslie Hugh, councillor from the Climate Council, Scott Gorringe, a Mithika man from Queensland's Channel Country, and Professor Hugh Possingham from the University of Queensland. Next up, we look to the future. What changes need to be made if we are to protect and conserve biodiversity? Here's RN's Greg Borschmann.
We've been talking about sustainable development ever since the 1980s. The UN Commission on Sustainable Development, the report Our Common Future came out then. It was a serious global push. The concept was embraced by the former Hawke government, a whole of government process, but it was abandoned here at least when it became obvious that ecologically sustainable development involved real change from business as usual. So, Leslie Hughes, what's changed in the 3 decades since, anything, and what must change for the future?
Well, I don't think enough has changed. In fact, we've gone backwards compared to what we were 3 decades ago. Our environment is noticeably more degraded than it was 3 decades ago. Look, a whole lot of things have to change I think the 1% environmental levy would be a very good start, but it would only be a start. I think what the average person in the public probably fails to realise is how much we rely on the biodiversity and our natural environment. It is our life support system. Without it, we don't exist. There's the fallacy that our economy can and our population can continue to grow infinitely. You know, the growth is good fallacy. At the moment, the Earth is using 1.5 planets to sustain its food and water and deal with its waste. Clearly, that's not sustainable. We need to keep reminding ourselves we're in a finite space with finite resources. And while we have got cleverer over the last few decades or centuries at exploiting those resources, it's come at a terrible price.
Hugh Possingham, this question is based on one submitted by a member of our audience tonight, Sue Ellen Smith. You're a member of the recent New South Wales Biodiversity Legislation Review Panel. The panel made various recommendations for making biodiversity and endangered species legislation more effective. How much will those tweaks or changes, if they're acted upon, be steamrolled by other realities? For example, we spoke earlier about those three massive new coal mines that have been approved recently in New South Wales. How does that process that you're working on, how does that integrate with the rest of government, or doesn't it? Is that the problem?
That's a good question. A very difficult question to answer. The tweaks we suggested were all about keeping it simple, but also providing more incentives and stewardship payments. So arguably, we were very interested in allowing landowners to manage their land easily and conveniently without a lot of red tape, but also being rewarded for doing good things. So there was a lot of hope that the government would invest in giving land managers, farmers, basically stewardship payments to do looking after threatened species.
Is this the way of the future?
And it has worked in places.
So a farmer gets paid not just for the milk or the wool that he produces or she produces. Mm. It's, you know, that you get paid for actually looking after a piece of country.
We've talked about it for a very, very long time in this country, people being paid for various ecosystem services to providing these broader community benefits. It occasionally happens in bits and pieces. There's a little flurry of ecosystem service payments, stewardship payments to farmers to regenerate declining woodlands and look after threatened species. But the trouble is, none of it's very permanent. The funding for those stewardship things ebb and wane, so there's no security. And this is why coming back to the environment levy is absolutely essential. You can't have an environment program that lasts 3 years. Nobody recovers any species in 3 years. It is entirely ridiculous. So people need to know that if they're going to have funding for species X, ecosystem Y, fire management regime, water controls, it will last for hundreds of years. It has to be built into the tax system. Just as we hope that we will also have a medical system in the future, we should have an environmental system that looks after those things.
Can I get a sense from all four of you here? I mean, what I seem to be hearing is that really the environmental problem that we have is an economic problem.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the economics is integrally tied to what's happening in the environment. I mean, we don't value natural capital. People don't usually understand where that steak came from or where the milk came from or where the cotton came from. And not only that, they're not actually costing the impact on the environment or what people call the cradle or the grave bit where we throw it away and what the costs are there. And so I think fundamentally we've got to think about the way our economic system grows up. It's very immature at the moment. It's not capable of dealing with this problem properly. And the whole idea that the market will sort it, I mean, we have endless examples in the environmental world of market failure. And so I think it is fundamentally important to think about how the two integrate so that, in fact, economics is just a subset of the environment.
And Scott Gorringe, the problem you're dealing with in your country is that at the moment it's valued at zero, and yet a gas company or any sort of mining company finds a mineral out there, it has value. Yeah. That's the problem, isn't it?
The perception that it's worth zero, yes.
But the economic system is valuing it at zero at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. That's kind of how they see it. So economics is a huge driver in the conversation around climate change and also environmental issues, trying to save our biodiversity. It's the absolute driver. You know, we've got large mining companies and governments who are kind of thinking that we're a bit hypocritical or that we're hypocrites out our way because we don't want to engage in the economics of the country. We're engaging in it. We've got tourism happening out our way. We've got existing industries in the rural industry happening out our way. We're not hypocrites. We know the value of economics, yet we don't want progression and all those sort of things at the expense of our country and our water. And I think there's, you know, they kind of look at us as being tree huggers and we don't know what's going on with economics. We do. I think I'd love to see a tax system where the people have got to say where their taxes go. I'd like to see, you know, where you could tick a box where I want to put 2% of my tax into environment. I want to put 1% into defence or something like that. You know, I don't know if it's possible. But
sorry, you just lost your application to be treasurer.
I want to have a say.
Sorry, Hugh Possingham, I cut you off then.
I mean, the civilised countries of the world, Sweden, Switzerland, France, Germany, they invest in landscapes. They pay land managers to deliver wildflower meadows, forests, wildlife. This is a big part of the United Kingdom. You know, you get paid for stone curlews and skylarks. So, you know, we've just gone so capitalist mad that if it doesn't make money, it's not worth doing. But people value landscapes and Australians value their biodiversity. Why aren't we paying for it?
Mm. Leslie Hughes, I was going to ask this question of Hugh Possingham because he's the mathematician, but I'm going to ask you, how much is the problem simply a biological one? And you know, you're a biologist, you understand these processes. The human capacity to breed, population growth. For several decades now, the consensus has been that world population will peak in 2050 at 9 billion, but a report only last year by the Population Matters think tank warned that global population could continue to rise and hit 11 billion by 2100.
Well, population's a huge problem, not so much because of the numbers, but because of the quality of the life that all of those people aspire to.
This is the footprint, the consumption.
It's the footprint idea. So, you know, I said at the moment we're living at about half a planet beyond our means. If everybody on the planet lived like we do here in Australia, we'd need 4.5 planets. So the actual raw population numbers is only part of the story. It's how the population lives. You know, we have, in theory, we know how to solve the climate change problem. We have enough technology and we have enough resources to do that. So it doesn't have to be that way. We can actually sustain a much greater carrying capacity of the Earth. It's how we do it that's important, not the raw numbers.
Mm. I'd like to also explore the issue of regulation, because we're talking about us as individuals, what we can do, what we should do. Hugh Possingham, I'd like to get a sense from you of where we are at in terms of regulation. You've just done that review in New South Wales. You're in Queensland at the moment. You told me recently that Queensland is a basket case in terms of environmental regulation. When you consider that the debate we're having at the moment is the federal government not vacating that space, but certainly making itself a little bit more scarce, what does Queensland tell us about environmental regulation and biodiversity?
So I have to go back there tomorrow, you know, Greg. Yeah, well, I think strangely enough that given we've brought in management of a whole heap of things like water management, management of native vegetation, threatened species legislation over much of Australia, I don't think there's many people in the rural communities who want to do environmental damage. In fact, I would say it was a tiny percentage, 1% or 2%. So I think regulation, really hard totalitarian regulation, those times have passed, but those people who manage country do want to see a reward for doing the right thing. There are very few bad people out there doing bad things, but if all the people who are doing good things don't really seem as though they're getting any acknowledgement from the community or any financial reward or they're doing things tough, that's where it's going wrong. And let's face it, we, elevating ourselves out into time and space, we are the filthiest, richest people in the filthiest, richest country the world has ever seen. There is never going to be a filthy, rich country and filthy, rich people like we're sitting in this room today. If we can't spare 3 or 4 cappuccinos a month to secure Australia's natural resources, then nobody's ever going to do it. You couldn't expect somebody in India to do it, you couldn't expect somebody in Mexico to do it, let alone the United States, because if we can't do it, nobody will do it.
I think we need to start exploring this sense of ourselves and the ownership, the individual ownership that we have of these issues. That was a question tonight from one of our audience, Duncan Bourne, who wanted to know, as individuals, what's the most effective action that we can take. So a reflection from all of you on optimism and denial and the human condition. Leslie Hughes, as a climate scientist, you say you operate with schizophrenia or bipolar disorder. Is this the tension between the spirit and the intellect?
Yes, it's the pessimism of the intellect and the optimism of the spirit is the phrase. Look, I'm optimistic and pessimistic on different days and sometimes within the same 5-minute period. I'm certainly less optimistic than Hugh is about the capacity of the human race to solve the climate change problem. Sir Nicholas Stern called climate change the greatest market failure of all time because most of the people that will suffer and most of the environment that will suffer most from climate change are not the same as the people that are causing it. So I'm not terribly optimistic, though occasionally there are little bright sparks in the day or the political cycle or the technological innovation that give me hope from time to time. But I think the main thing that drives me and what I do is the knowledge, the absolute belief that without maintaining a degree of hope and optimism, we really are stuffed. You know, we actually have to keep going as if we can win, because if we don't do that, we won't win.
So how do you own the problem? How do you go to sleep at night?
I go to sleep at night thinking about what I'm going to do tomorrow to keep trying. And that's all you can do. If I could quote the great Mahatma Gandhi, it's a quote that I often use at the end of seminars. He said, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. I think we're still in the third phase of that. We're still fighting, and we have to keep fighting or we won't win. Mm-hmm.
Richard Kingsford, in terms of your lifetime, what have we lost? What did you see then that you no longer see, and will we ever see it again? Is extinction forever?
My grandfather was born in Kenya. He was a postman, and his big problem going between delivering mail was black rhinos. Whenever he went, he'd be charged. You go to the place where he was a postman, and you won't see a black rhino for hundreds of kilometres. And to me, that tells me just how quickly we've lost perhaps one of the most iconic, not all of them, animals on this planet. Besides all that, I'm an eternal optimist. I actually believe in the human condition. I believe in our ability to get this right. But I think we've got some major challenges. I spend a lot of time in rural Australia, and I spend time with Aboriginal people, and they all tell me the same thing. They really care about place. They care about function. They care about sustainability. But somehow, we're not actually getting that message through to our political leaders. Our political leaders are still on the same old economic paradigm of growth, 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 whatever that means. I mean, we know that some of these metrics of growth are very poor in terms of measuring sustainability. And we have to get a lot smarter. We have to actually think about much more what we define as our quality of life. And we have to have less of an impact on things. I mean, we are over-consuming everything. There's no need for us to over-consume. That's not where we buy happiness or we get happiness. We need to think about how we can exercise less of an impact on this planet.
You talk about political leadership. You say this problem requires, as well as personal commitment, political leadership. What do you mean? Are you talking about an environmental war cabinet, or are you talking about environmental bipartisanship? Because that is certainly something that we have not seen in this country for decades.
Well, that's very interesting. I mean, you look at the world and you look at, there was bipartisan view about environment in most of the first world countries or the Western world for some time. I think what has happened is that because suddenly this environment issue is so-called impacting on the economic engines, that we've seen the conservative governments go towards saying we've got to distance ourselves from that without saying, well, this is a big issue that we actually have to come together on and try and solve. I mean, my real concern is that most governments in Australia and oppositions of major parties produce the most superficial environment policies you've ever seen. They are very, very poor. They do not cut to the quick of what this issue is about. They are not comprehensive. They tend to be idiosyncratic about we'll do a bit of this and a bit of that, and we won't really deal with the major issues. When I lecture my first year students, I say, don't just look at the environment policy. Look at the natural resource policy as well. So you could be saying, we're saving a river, but by the way, we're going to build 100 dams across Australia. So, you know, it's about having the conversation about those yin and yang.
Scott Gorringe, out in the Channel Country, what future do you see for the Black Hawk? A totem for the generations to come?
I hope so. We'll continue the conversations. All's not lost out our way. We've battled pretty hard, and we'll continue to do that with really deadly people that work with us to move forward with trying to save our country. So it's not lost. There's still some good river country out there. There's still floods coming through our lands. So the Black Hawk is not going anywhere. We'll be around for a long time. Just need to engage all of you. I notice in this audience there's a lot of young people, and so you all be aware of Facebook. So, you know, before you there was a lot of young people, and now those young people aren't here as old people. So something, there's a disconnect happening. And so don't just like it, engage in it.
I'm going to give all four of you notice of this question because it's probably, it is a very good one. It comes from Rebecca Spindler here at the zoo. And I want a one-sentence answer. And Rebecca asks, what is working and how do we get more of it? So I'll give you all a moment to think about that while I ask Hugh Possingham. In 1957, Neville Shute wrote the novel On the Beach. After the detonation of 4,000 nuclear weapons in the Northern Hemisphere and the inevitable radioactive destruction of life on Earth, one of the striking features of the human response was both optimism and denial, almost to the final day. With the extinction crisis, when will the penny drop? What will the tipping point be?
I agree with Richard in a way. There's some disconnect when WWF and other groups polled the Australian people about the Great Barrier Reef. Over 90% of people wanted the entire Great Barrier Reef a marine park. When we poll the world, the majority of people in the world want 50% of the entire landmass national park. But we haven't achieved either of those things. Everybody wants everything that's good for the environment. Nobody disputes the sustainability, the need for sustainable fisheries, the need for sustainable water use. So how come if everybody wants the same thing and we live in a democracy, it doesn't happen?
So a final question, a one-sentence answer from all of you. What is working and how do we get more of it? Leslie Hughes.
I hope that our relentless attempts at educating the Australian public about climate change and the risks associated with it is working. Last Lowy poll said 63% of the Australian public are very concerned about climate change, up from 39% about 3 years ago. So here's hoping.
Scott Gorringe, what's working and how do we get more of it?
What's working is deadly, passionate, extremely intelligent people. That's what's working. They're the people that I've had the pleasure to be working with over the last couple of years, and I think we need more of that.
Hugh Possingham?
I think rural communities are working. In South Australia, we, in 1995, were already working with the Farmers Federation to stop and secure land clearing and improve vegetation that is slowly spreading around the country. All we need to do now is recognise that and reward the people for doing good stuff.
Richard Kingsford?
Probably repeating what others have said, but I think information is critical. I think engagement is very important, and fundamentally commitment to the environment is probably the most important thing.
Richard Kingsford, Leslie Hughes, Hugh Possingham, Scott Gorringe, thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, could we please acknowledge indeed a big thank you for our four expert guests tonight.
You've been listening to highlights of The Extinction Crisis, Man the Lifeboats, presented by the Society for Conservation Biology at the Taronga Zoo last week in Sydney. Our thanks to RN's Greg Borschman for chairing tonight's discussion, and to our panel, Leslie Hughes, Distinguished Professor who heads the Climate Change Ecology Group at Macquarie University, Hugh Possingham, Professor of Mathematics and Ecology at the University of Queensland, Scott Gorringe, Director and founder of Murray Matters Consulting, a Mithika man from Queensland's Channel Country, and Richard Kingsford, Director of the Centre for Ecosystem Science at the University of New South Wales.
Can you teach someone to be heroic? And how would you feel about combat medals for drone operators or socially engineered moral crusaders? This week on Future Tense, how our notions of heroism are changing and who or what could be the hero of the future. Just imagine trying to pin a medal on something made of Kevlar and titanium. A heroic edition of Future Tense. Download the program from the RN website or look for us on iTunes.